Well, ever since Johann Rupert threw John Steenhuisen under the bus in the Oval Office, there's been more attention paid to crime in the Western Cape, and in particular to Cape Town. And what happened to MP Ian Cameron, who ironically is the chair of the Committee in Parliament on SA Police, and two of his fellow members of Parliament last week, has just stirred the pot a little bit more. So how bad is it? We'll find out today that these aren't isolated incidents. Things are maybe being swept under the carpet a little. So let's bring them into the open. Joining us today are Wayne Kutzer, who's the managing director of Vergelegen Estate. It's a very famous wine estate in South Africa. And Paul Trelevin, who is an anti-crime activist. Wayne, let's just pick up or start with you. You dropped me a note to say that there is a thing called the Running the Gauntlet along the N2 near the Cape Town airport, and that your family has personal experience. Just take us through the story of what happened to your son.
Absolutely. And thank you, Alec. So it's quite interesting. If you attend any dinner parties in this part of the Helderberg or Somerset West, or yesterday my wife went to see the hairdresser and came back and said, you won't believe it, someone who was having their hair done was attacked as well on the N2. So our incident was certainly not isolated. There seems to be everyone you speak to has had something along that N2 that's happened to them. Our incident, we've had two. I've had several. Two staff, in fact, horribly affected. Sales reps, you're on that road every day trying to earn a living selling wine in Cape Town and surrounds. They've been involved in boulders being thrown through the windows, smash and grabs on the N2. Maurice was very lucky. She got off lightly at Mister. But on the one occasion, she was hit by the shattering glass. And then my son 2 weeks ago was coming back after work at 5:30 in the afternoon, and the traffic slowed down just after the airport, and a massive boulder was thrown at his window. If it had been an inch closer to his driver's seat, it would have killed him. Luckily, it went through the back window and landed in the back of the vehicle. But, you know, having these are just two close incidents that have happened. But as I say, this small community who really rely on that road to work, most people work in Cape Town or come from Cape Town and work here. It is known as Running the Gauntlet. It has got very dangerous. I mean, you do see police presence, but not all the time. I've certainly never seen a drone. I've heard about these drones that patrol this road all the time, but I've never seen one. And quite honestly, we don't go out after 5:30. We do not go into Cape Town. And my biggest concern is that all tourists coming from the Cape to the Winelands, this part of the Winelands, have to use that road. And there have been tourists that have had bad incidents.
Just explain the road for those who don't know the Cape that well. You get out at Cape Town International Airport, and what part of the road are we talking about here, Wayne?
So you get out of Cape Town International, and you can turn right and go to Cape Town, which that stretch seems to be okay as far as I understand, although I wouldn't like to be traveling that stretch at night. But if you turn left and you head towards Somerset West, Elgin, Gebro on that road, that is the road, the N2 that is lethal. It's also a hell of a mess, to be honest with you, Alec. It's, you know, I moved from Natal to Cape Town, and when you move here, it's like moving to heaven, apparently. And so I can honestly say none of this ever happened to me in Natal. But the Capetonians speak about the Cape being very special, and it is, and that there's no crime and all the rest. But I think there's a little bit of a cover-up, because everyone I speak to has been affected in some way or the other on the roads. And so that road, the particularly bad part of that road is about 4 kilometers after the airport. There's a stretch, and it's the stretch that has tons of litter on the side of the road. It looks like, I mean, internationals coming here are horrified. It's like an apocalyptical sight. there's horses and rubbish and dogs. And I understand we've got issues which we're trying to resolve in this country. But, you know, for tourists, it's really your first introduction to this, to the Cape.
Well, you referred me to Paul. And Paul, maybe you can tell us your story, why you became so interested in this whole issue.
So we were traveling back from the Roy Els Hermanus area on Sunday the 13th to catch a flight back to Johannesburg. And at about 16:10, we'd just passed under the Muwe Bridge on the N2 going towards the airport. And I noticed the overhead airport signage coming up. So I started moving over from the fast lane to the middle lane, then I moved to the left lane. And about 500 meters or so past the Muwe Bridge, there's a pedestrian bridge. And just before that, there's a blue overhead sign. Where the column is for that sign, as we drove past there, I saw something flash up from behind the Onco barrier. And it was the figure of a human, and then I saw something hurtling towards the car. All happened in a flash of like less than a second. So there was this massive explosion, and it went through the passenger window. My wife was luckily bending forward at that stage. She was putting a handbag down at her feet. And the piece of concrete, which I estimate weighs about 5 kilos, hit the headrest where her head would have been if she'd been sitting back. But the glass from the window that shattered cut her face all over and went into her eyes and cut her cornea. So she was screaming that she couldn't see. So I quickly said to her, just look at me so I can see what's going on. And then I said to her, hold your scarf, which she had around her neck, over your face and put pressure on your face because I'm not going to stop until we get to a place of safety. So we carried on driving, and probably 30 seconds or so later, a car came up on my right, and there were two guys in the car, two colored guys. I estimate mid-30s. They both had mirror sunglasses on, and they were shouting at me. So I thought they were saying that they'd seen what happened or that they were willing to help us. So I opened the window to see what they had to say. They said to me that I'd killed a kid and that I needed to stop. So then I immediately assessed the car, and I looked at the bonnet and I looked at the mirror on the passenger side and things like that to see if there's any damage from a pedestrian accident. And I assumed that there was no damage. So I said to my wife, look, these guys are in on this. I'm not going to stop. I'm carrying on going to the airport. So then they cut in front of me. They started slowing down. They put their hazards on, and then they tried to stop me. So I evaded them by swerving to the right, went around them, got back into the fast lane and headed to the airport. I saw them coming up behind me, and then I lost them on the way to the airport. On the way there, I was calling 10111. We made calls from both our phones, and to this day, I'm still waiting for them to answer the call.
Sure. That's a bit of a hectic experience that you had there, Paul. And as a consequence of that, you've taken a big interest in exactly what's going on.
Yeah, you know, before that, I'd known about these attacks because they've been ongoing for 21 years odd. And I was aware that the N2 could be unsafe. So when I saw the figure pop up from behind the Onco barrier, I knew exactly what was happening. But like I said, my wife was caught totally off guard. And then I decided, look, this has happened to us now. It's close as possible that it can be to me. So I'm going to become active in trying to sort this problem out, solve the problem, contact the politicians, contact the mayor, contact the premier, police, et cetera, et cetera, which I've been doing. And I've had very little response from anyone. The mayor actually called me after I sent him about 15 emails. Then I emailed Condé Nast Travel Magazine. I copied him in on the email, and that same afternoon I got the call from the mayor. Alan Windy actually blocked me on his Facebook profile because he wasn't answering the email. So when I went onto his Facebook profile, whenever he posted a post about something, it was actually a post where they were standing, a video unveiling a sign for a new housing development. So I put a comment on there. I said, when are you going to answer my emails? And I got blocked access to his Facebook account.
We're here to serve you.
Yep, that's civil servants for you.
Wayne, from your perspective, clearly you've got a vested interest. You've got a dog in the fight. You guys are a wine estate. You get a lot of international visitors.
Absolutely. We get over 100,000 international visitors a year to the farm. And so it is vitally important. But for me, it's really first and foremost about this community and our staff and the people who live in the Helderberg Basin and Somerset West, the people we see every day, who travel that road daily to Cape Town and back, who I'm worried about. And of course, the tourists play a huge part, and we'd hate anything to happen to any of them. I did have very good feedback from the mayor, who said they're dealing with it. And of course, John also wrote a letter to me apologizing. But, since then, there has been a bit of more apparently, I'm told, I haven't been into Cape Town, but there has been more policing on that road, apparently. We've got Cape Wine coming up next week, which is the biggest sort of conference for Cape wine experts around the world who are flying into Cape Town. We've got a number of international buyers coming out to the farm and coming out to all the farms in this area. And of course, it's a huge concern that should anything happen to them, it literally turns off the taps for any hospitality business.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary situation here that Cape Town is getting wonderful press at the moment. There are many tourists coming into the Cape. In fact, I think Cape Town is now ranking as the best destination on a number of these surveys around the world. And I guess one incident like what happened with you, Paul, let's just imagine that it happened to a Cape wine buyer or somebody who works for the New York Times. Well, it could turn off the taps. My question really is to the two of you, what would you like to see happening? Paul?
Well, first of all, the cameras weren't working on the highway. The mayor admitted that to me, so did the Metro Police. So I'd like to see the cameras working properly. I'd like to see police patrols on the highway. We never saw a single police vehicle from the moment we got onto the N2N Strand all the way to the airport, not one. They should possibly look at putting Nyala type vehicles along the highway stationary, where they have policemen stationed in the vehicles all the time, every kilometer or so. And then I would like to see a big solid concrete wall of about 20 foot high, 3 meters high, with the barrier on top of that, but a reinforced concrete wall that cannot be dismantled and broken down to secure the highway from the neighboring areas.
How long is the border with the dangerous areas that you're talking about?
It's like Wayne said, it's probably about a 4 kilometer stretch. And the mayor did say to me that they're looking at building a wall. They just got to find the money to do it. But like I said, this has been ongoing for 21 years. If there was a political will to put that wall up, it would have been there already. So a lot of people have died and been injured since then. So if the wall was up, it probably could have saved a few lives by now. But yeah, like Wayne said, it's probably about a 4 kilometer stretch and it's going to cost a lot of money, but it's going to have to be done.
I like the other
thing.
When
you say a lot of people have died, sorry, Wayne, Paul, just elaborate. A lot of people have died or been injured.
I've been researching all the incidents on that piece of road over the years, and there's been, I think, 4 tourists that have been killed. 2 South Africans, I think, that pulled over and got shot and robbed. And then on the R300, a week after our incident, a lady had a flat tire. I don't know whether it was sparked or what caused the flat tire, but she pulled off the road and she was shot through the head.
Wow. Wayne?
Yeah, Alec, it's also about the communities that live on either side of that too, because you often drive into Cape Town, there's always a police stop and there's always a body bag somewhere. So children are crossing that road and getting run over. It's absolutely horrific. And there's a number of casualties on that road. Often dogs are hit. It's a very bad road, and it is not managed properly. It's a long stretch. I know it's a hard shot for the municipality managed, but something has to be done. It's also about the people crossing. There's no area for them to cross safely. There's kids playing soccer, which is wonderful. There's nowhere else for them to play soccer. But, you know, a ball goes into a road, and then before you know it, a kid's in front of your car. It's just not ideal. Something clever needs to be done along that road. to prevent all these accidents.
So what would you recommend?
So I do think a fence of some sort would obviously work. I also feel if you put a proper fence, then internally you could do something for the community as well. They could build maybe two or three proper football pitches for people to play football contained in the fenced area, which would be lovely. The litter, as I say, I know it's a massive problem for me. There's piles and piles of litter, often smoldering, tires burning. That needs to be addressed somehow. They've now put lavatories on the outside of the existing broken concrete fence there. It doesn't look great, so you'll pass 30 or 40 plastic lavatories. It really is a sight to behold. It needs serious commitment from the private sector and from the municipality. Get together and come up with a formal plan to actually sort it out. And I'm sure everyone would get involved. It's our livelihood.
It's very much in the focus at the moment of public-private partnerships after Yanni Mouton has made the biggest donation ever in South Africa by taking his foundation, buying Curro Schools, getting it sold back for 1 rand. So effectively, it's a 7.2 billion rand donation to turn it into a non-profit so that it can expand more rapidly and make a bigger impact on education. I was hoping that the example that Yanni is setting would spark some kind of a realization from the private sector that government can't do everything. Is there any attempt from the private sector in the area to actually get involved in this? You know, you talk about it being going on for 21 years. You talk about the impact that this could have on the entire tourism industry. Is there anything that you could do, Wayne, and I'll ask you as well, Paul, in a moment, that could show those who are dealing with the public resources that everybody is serious about this and we can join hands and address what is clearly a dangerous situation? The longer you try and sweep things under the carpet, the more danger or the more risk there is of just one of those being the reporter from the New York Times, the buyer, the international buyer for a wine farm, etc., some high-profile individual who then turns this into something which is almost irreparable.
I'm certainly not aware of anything that's been done to collaborate with the private sector, but I feel that now's the time that we could put something together, and we could certainly facilitate that here and then work from there. But I think everyone would buy in. I think the time has come. Everyone is speaking about it.
Just needs a bit of leadership, perhaps.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Very happy to start it, start the ball rolling.
And Paul, from your side, is there anything that you could get involved with apart from pointing out the obvious now, which is that this is a very dangerous area?
Well, I've been speaking to Wayne, and that's why I got in touch with him in the first place, to see if we could come up with ideas and perhaps approach government and the a public sector as well to see how we can get something done to solve this problem. So in the early stages, we haven't, like Wayne said, there's been no real feedback from the private sector, but I think if we keep on with it and we make more and more people aware of what's going on, we can get companies involved and companies in that area involved, such as DSV Logistics. They actually were quite helpful with their cameras because they may have caught a shot of the car that followed us on their cameras. So, you know, companies that are in that area along the route, et cetera, might be willing to get involved and be part of the project. But we'll put our heads together and see what we can come up with.
Also, people like brilliant companies like Clearview Fencing, et cetera, we could collaborate with a number of great companies that I'm sure would come together to make it a safe place.
Yeah, it's interesting that you've raised this now, and it's in the public domain, and the Facebook groups and the comments, and there are just so many people who isolated were impacted, but now they're seeing that they weren't on their own, and perhaps that can start some kind of a momentum to address this. But I suppose in the long term, it's not a problem that's going to go away without some real focus and real intention. Paul, did you have any insight into whether your incident was isolated. Clearly, you hadn't knocked a child over, otherwise you wouldn't have been telling us that story. Were there others who had a similar circumstance, or were they the body bag inhabitants that you were referring to earlier?
Well, we've been trying to make contact with people that have been attacked along the highway, and we found that a lot of people haven't reported to the police because they think they're not going to get any joy. So there's probably hundreds of cases that haven't been reported, which makes the stats look a lot lower than what they are. But through one of the city councillors in Cape Town from the Freedom Run Plus, they've been assisting in locating previous victims, and I've asked that we can all be put in contact with each other and see who has laid charges and who hasn't, so we can build up stats and we can find out how many people are actually involved in this. But besides Wayne and one or two other people that the council has put me in touch with so far, I haven't spoken to anyone else as yet. But I know there are numerous people that don't report these incidents.
So let me just understand this, Wayne. You're driving on that road going towards the airport, say from here where I live in Hermanus, and out of the blue, some guy who's from an informal settlement nearby or who's part of a gangster deal will throw a brick at you or at your car. And if you're lucky, it's not going to hit you. If you're not, but that's not, you need to be a lot luckier because you could have some gangster coming up to you and forcing you off the road, and who knows what might happen then. Is that what is going on there?
Absolutely. So, and when you say a brick, Alec, it's not, the rock that is thrown at Jack's car would have taken two people to lift that and throw it. These are boulders, big pieces of cement. It's not necessarily a brick, although I've heard of the bricks being thrown. But in both instances, my staff member and my son, they were big pieces of concrete. And they were talking a big chunk of concrete.
Oh, yeah. So, a block of concrete.
Yeah.
Yo. So, from a bridge? Are they throwing it down from a bridge, or how do they toss
from
it?
A little bit of an elevated bank section in our case. That was the story. But one of the other two of the other scams that happen is they drive up next to you, and I've heard this happening a lot on that road, and slow next to you and then point to your front tire, indicating that there's a problem. And of course you pull over, and there's been a few people that have had that happen to them and have been robbed. And then the other one is they also pull up to you and show you a number plate that's not yours. They show it to you backwards and say your number plate's dropped off. So I know someone who's had that but was clever enough to realize they didn't have that style of number plate. I mean, the rule of thumb is do not stop at any cost. If your tire goes, you just drive on the rims until you get to the airport and then turn in there if you can. But that is the rule. We've briefed all our family and kids and everyone in the area. You just drive.
And a tourist wouldn't know that, presumably.
And
Paul, what's the rules that you pass on to people? Paul, what would you recommend?
Are you talking to me?
Yeah, Paul.
Same as Wayne. I've told people not to stop, and I've told people to use the middle lane all the time because Wayne's son was attacked on the driver's side of the vehicle, so that came from the middle island. Mm. We were attacked on the passenger side, which came from the side of the road on the slow lane side. So I would suggest the middle lane. Do not move from the middle lane when you're going through that section, and don't be isolated. Make sure there's lots of other vehicles around, and don't stop. Like Wayne said, if you have flat tires, ride on the rims, but don't stop. Because the police commander actually said to me, if we had stopped, the two guys that were trying to force us off the road would have shot us and robbed us.
Wow.
And the other issue is, I presume you drive in the daylight, Paul?
We were at 10 past 4 in the afternoon, so it was daylight, yeah, but a lot of people can't. Like, I have a friend that went back to Cape Town last night because I'm in Pretoria, and she was only landing at 8 o'clock last night, and she had to drive back to Stellenbosch, so she had to use that route. So she was going to have her husband on the phone while she was driving, as well as her location all the time on WhatsApp. So, but other than that, some people are forced to use that road at night.
Absolutely. A lot of the international flights land quite late.
Yeah.
In summer, it's probably okay. But having said that, I'm not sure because Jack was attacked sort of at 5:30. So it certainly wasn't dark. But the international flights in winter land, you know, rather late, and you've got to travel that road.
What about tour operators, Wayne, to close off with? Have you had any feedback from them? Are they concerned?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I had a whole lot of DMCs and tour operators here last week for a site inspection, and it is a concern. It's something that's raised, is that you get, they prefer to use the wine farms located centrally, but they will do morning excursions. It is a, it's a definite concern for them.
So if they are picking people up from the airport at night, they would presumably be at risk. Especially if these are international tourists, so they're not going to turn left when they come out of the Cape Town airport. They're going to make sure they don't go along what you call running.
There's a lot of wine farms to choose from. You don't have to come to the Helderberg or to Elgin. There's a number of wine farms situated close to Cape Town or in Cape Town, and you know, people are missing out. They need to be able to come out here safely. And as I say, most importantly, as well as our staff who travel that road every single day.
Wayne Kutze is the chief executive of the Vergelegen Wine Estate. Paul Treleaven is an anti-crime activist. And I'm Alec Hogg from BizNews.com.